This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That you didn't believe would exist anymore. And that was sort of the genesis of it. And I guess I was carrying it for a long time. And 6 years ago or so, I decided I would consider writing a book about it or return to that time and try to figure out what it was all about, pursue that question.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been working on it for 6 years?
Yes. Maybe 45 years, but 6 years in earnest.
Now, why did you choose to tell the story through two characters, Francine and Colville, who were children at the time of the church's work to survive the end of the world in this time period in the late 80s and into 1990? Why did you want to focus on them?
I think I wasn't sure how to start the story, and I was fortunate in that a student who was not a student in a class of mine, but a student who I knew at Reed College where I teach, I found out that she had been a child in the church at the same time during the shelter cycle, and furthermore that her father had built a shelter for 70 people. And I got in touch with her. She graduated and moved back to Bozeman. And I ended up going back and forth to Montana several times to talk to her and to interview friends of hers and interview her family, and gradually, I guess, gaining people's trust so I could talk to more people. And in talking to people who are about 30 now about their childhood growing up in the church, they had this amazing sense of wonder and the happiest memories of growing up because they were out in this beautiful landscape and they were given a lot of freedom in the wilderness because they believed that they were guarded by these nature spirits, and they believed that their family and, you know, their community had a knowledge that no one else had, and furthermore, that they were going to save the world. And on top of that, their parents were building what they described as the coolest fort you can ever imagine, you know, 40 feet underground, these incredible structures. So I wanted, I guess, to convey that sense of wonder, and I wanted to tell a happy story. I felt like a church that many people would call a cult, the obvious story is a critical one or one that is a parody of some kind. And I wanted to take it seriously, but I wanted to see if I could tell a happy story. And telling it from a child's perspective was one way into that. And I guess the other side of that was that the beliefs themselves are so complicated and the cosmology involves so many things that it was easier to limit how I talked about it if the characters during that time who I was dealing with were children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This might be a good time to hear a passage from the book, the opening passage, which deals with these characters.
Okay. I guess, so you need to know nothing. Except this is the voice of the character Francine, and she is writing a letter to try to make sense of her childhood to herself, to her child. She's very pregnant when she writes this. When I was out by myself in the mountains, I liked to think he was somewhere in the trees. I hiked up the canyons over the ridge and under the pines and aspens to a place where an old cabin had been. It was only a stone chimney and foundation all broken down. I tore out long grass for a bed, then stepped through the doorway, a gap in the stones with no walls on either side. I could hear dogs barking far away when I closed my eyes. I heard the stream nearby, the wind and the leaves above, and I heard my name. Francine, Francine. He stood in the doorway, wearing his dark blue Cub Scout shirt, the patches on his pocket, and his jeans with holes in the knees, Colville Young. He pretended to knock on the door, then stepped inside and stretched out next to me on the bed of grass. We were 10 years old, 11. He was shorter and his arms were too long for his body, and his hair was almost white, even lighter than mine. High above, the aspen's leaves slapped, the blue sky bright between them. I listened to Colville's breathing, trying to match mine to it. My shoulder felt his shoulder, even though we didn't touch. I turned my head, his ear so close to my mouth. When I moved my fingers down along my side, they touched his, and we both pulled away. Eyes closed, we listened to the stream, its liquid sounds, the voices of undines, the nature spirits who served water. I imagined all the elementals looking down at the two of us. On our bed of green grass, they were the servants of God and man in the plains of matter, which is where we were living, where they protected us. The undines in the water and the spirits that serve the fire element called salamanders. Elementals of the earth were gnomes, those of the air, sylphs. The thoughts we had out in nature were actually the elementals making their wishes seem like ours. We built tiny homes for them filled with quartz crystal in the little caves of the splintery cliffs. The elementals were part of the reason our parents let us play alone out there. Our parents, they had so much to do, so many preparations to make. It was fortunate for everyone that we had spiritual protection.
Thank you. That's Peter Rock reading from his new novel, The Shelter Cycle. And what I'd like to get into with you is about the differentiation between those two characters and how they have a different reaction to the experience of 20 years ago being a child in this church. But I think we might need to go to a break first.
Okay.
So let's hear from Membership Central. We are, as I mentioned, speaking with Peter Rock, who teaches at Reed College and is the author of The Shelter Cycle. And right now we take a break in this interview and go to Ani and Ivan.
Yes, thank you, Lynn. Good morning. We're here. And we're listening to Peter Rock reading from The Shelter Cycle. You know, for a $60 minimum pledge, you can get an autographed copy of Peter's book. Isn't that right, Ani?
That is absolutely right. You are listening to the interview. You can take a book with you when you call 877-500-5266. And let us know that you are listening and that you care about your community radio station. That autographed copy of Peter's book can be yours for a $60 contribution. You can put it on your credit card when you dial 877-500-5266, or you can do it $5 a month, just $5 a month. So easy to do for just about everyone listening to this interview. If you have, a couch or a good armchair, shake it down for some change and do that for a few days running. And I bet pretty much you can find $5 sitting around in change in your house, in the bottom of your backpack, you know, that cup that you always throw the change into. You know, turn that change into social change. Bring it into your community radio station. If you have $5 this month, take a leap of faith and just, you know, assume you're going to have $5 next month and the month after that. And KBOO and your entire community can benefit from your largesse. Just call 877-500-5266. Or online, you can donate at kboo.fm. We are looking to raise $250 by noon, and you can help that happen. $250, it's easy to do when we break it down. That's actually a couple people giving at $10 a month. Again, a very sustainable and doable rate for so many people. If you give $10 a month, it gets us just about halfway to that goal. It's a great thing. 877-500-5266. We thank that person for their call. It's great to hear the phone ring. And let's go ahead and fill up the other four lines right now with your support. 877-500-5266.
That's right, Ani. You know, it's just nickels and dimes, really, is what we need from you. You know, if that's all you can give, great. That will be enough to have you become part of this thriving radio station. Your change, your checkbook, your credit card, whatever it takes, we would like to hear from you at 877-500-5266. Sorry. We are behind by only about 15%, and you know the drive ends this Saturday, so won't you become a part of this now, today, right now, at this moment, 11:12 a.m. on April 4th? Become a member. Have this day be your day to become part of KBOO. 877-500-5266. Or go online. If you're listening online, if you're sitting at your desk at work somewhere, just click over. No one will see. KBOO.FM.
Thank you. Thank you, Ivan, and thank you, Ani. And again, I am speaking with Peter Rock about his new novel, The Shelter Cycle. And we ended our first segment by me asking you about the two characters, Francine and Colville, and the two paths that they seem to have taken, which are quite different, and the way they're struggling with what is happening now 20 years later. Can you talk about the difference in their response to this background?
Sure. I think paths is the right way to talk about it. That's how someone in the church would describe their life. I think I had this idea for writing the book, The Shelter Cycle, and as I said, it was a very discrete period of time from, you know, the mid to late 80s into 1990. And at first I thought I would just tell that period of time. And as I said before, I was interested in how the children told the story because it was simpler and it was also a happier story. And then I started to talk to people who had been children, and I started to think, I just wrote My Abandonment, which has a 13-year-old narrator, and I want to write about some adults. And the flip side of the happiness of these people's childhood is they're, you know, the people I talk to are relatively happy now, but they would talk about how they had left the church when they were fairly young and their families no longer were in the church, and they had intellectually removed themselves from these beliefs, but in moments of stress in their lives or other big moments, especially pregnancy, the beliefs would come back. So they would say, I was in this intense situation and suddenly I heard myself chanting. And it's as if this vestigial belief is in them that they can't get out. And so I wanted to explore that. And I also wanted to explore through Colville and Francine really different ways that having really extreme beliefs at a young age might be made manifest. So Colville is much more engaged with the beliefs on the day-to-day, and in a way that is very close to how he might have believed when he was a child. Francine is more reluctant, but the beliefs are coming back to her. She's pregnant and she's wondering. The church has a lot of interesting beliefs about childhood. Among them, you know, you're able to shift your child's DNA by doing certain things while they're in the womb. Young babies, there are a lot of rules around them. You're not allowed to touch their heads. People outside of the immediate family aren't allowed to touch them or hold them for long periods of time. And there's a lot of attention given to what the first words are and what children talk about. And rather than treating children as if they should be instructed or taught how to speak like other people or to make sense, they were treated as sort of emissaries from the ether who were talking perhaps about past lives or bringing wisdom that we who would, you know, were conscious in an adult way were not aware of.
Now, you're a father. Did any of these techniques or these beliefs that you were researching and writing about, did they seep into your own child-rearing practices?
Oh, certainly. I always tell my students, and I feel like those things that we're drawn to or those things we're really curious about, it's not a coincidence. Those are things that are inside us in some way that we're searching for, trying to figure out. And that, for me, had a few effects. One was, you know, I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, surrounded by Mormons, and I've always had a real resistance to organized religion. And I think having children put me in a place where I was slightly less cynical, and I was ready to sort of think about some of these issues in a different way. And I think, you know, that will happen to anyone having children. And I think reading about all of these more extreme child-rearing practices definitely seeped in, made me reconsider some things. And I don't know, I think everyone probably listens to their children carefully and the strange things they say. But I wrote a lot of things down, and I think they... And another thing is, say, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, the messenger who was the head of the church, she would talk about all of her past lives, and she would talk about experiences she had when she was growing up in New Jersey when she realized that she was in Egypt for a moment. So that kind of thing is something that children bring to us.
Mm-hmm. And I read that you wanted to convey a respect. You mm-hmm. didn't want this to be a parody or a satire. You wanted mm-hmm. this novel to also be respectful of what you found out about.
Yeah, I mean, I think respectful of the beliefs, but more importantly, maybe respectful of the people I interviewed, because I went to Montana the first time and I felt like maybe I wouldn't have put it this way, but looking back on it, there was a part of it, a small part of it maybe, that was, these are some people who did some really crazy things, and I'm going to mine it for my purposes. And a larger part was, I want to find out about this and I want to see what's going on. When I started talking to people, I realized that they were really smart. Their reasons for being involved in the church were good. They had a sense of humor about it, and they had thought about spiritual concerns and they had acted on them in a way that I never had. And I sort of, after the first series of interviews, I had to go, had to come back to Portland and spend about a year reading and researching the beliefs so I could feel qualified to even talk to these people. And so it was a real education for me, in a spiritual way, but also just in terms of being a human being and trying to understand people who are really different than I am. And that's what, for me, writing is about, that kind of empathy. That's why we read fiction, too, I think, to try to imagine how another person would think and how they would feel.
I think that's, for me, as a reader of the book, one of the great things about it is that it had many mysteries in it. And so many things about it were mysterious as I was encountering them, and trying to figure out what was happening was a great challenge. And it was really an enticing book. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And I want to let people know that I am speaking with Peter Rock. He is a professor of English at Reed College, of creative writing, might be more accurate. And we're talking about his latest book, which is The Shelter Cycle. And Peter has been kind enough to autograph some copies of this that are available as a thank you gift during this interview. So if you would like to join KABU right now and take advantage of that offer, we ask you now to give us a call. And I think right now we're joined by Ani and Ivan, who can tell you more about that process, and hopefully you will make that call of support right now.
Right now, that's exactly it. We need to hear from you right now at 877-500-5266 so that you can know that your support is coming into your community radio station, which provides news and information and culture and arts and literary arts and performing arts. Really, oh so much, delivered to your ear every day, every hour from your community radio station, brought to you by other community members. And we'd love to include you in that mix. 877-500-5266. If you're interested in picking up a copy of The Shelter Cycle by Peter Rock, you're listening to the interview right now. It's a $60 contribution to your community radio station, and you can take that novel as our thank you gift, as we want to thank you for supporting your entire community. $60 a year can be put on a credit card and paid for all at once, or you can break it down, $5 a month. Really simple and easy to do. It's a lot easier for me to give $5 a month than $60 at any given time, but I'm giving $15 a month because I can do that. I can work that in. That's like, you know, really a couple of lunches out, and I can kind of adjust how I spend my money so that I can make sure that those things that are important to me, that feed me spiritually and intellectually, can in fact get my support. And so I'm much easier. In fact, it's possible for me to give $15 a month. I could never come up with $180 at any one time. I know me. I could not do that. So if you are able to break down just a little bit of money every month for your community radio station, it adds up in the course of a year, and you'll find yourself being able to support your community to a level that you hadn't really thought about before. It's easy to do. $5 a month, $7 a month, $10 a month, what you can afford, we would love to accept and welcome you into our community of active, radioactive, participating members. 877-500-5266.
Yeah, you know, we are in the middle of our spring membership drive, and as I got up in the last break and looked out the window, I saw it had returned to Portland spring. It's gray, it's rainy. Maybe you're feeling that right now. Maybe you're sitting at home or wherever and listening to the radio, and maybe you're a little bit isolated. I know a lot of people who live alone and just have the radio on for company, leave the radio on maybe for their pets even when they go away for some live company. You know, you don't get that on the internet. You don't get that on television because most often, it's not live. We're live voices happening right now. As as the minutes go by, we are talking to you and it's live. And if you call right now at 877-500-5266, you will not get a recording. You will, in fact, get one of our skilled volunteers answering the phone, and it will be a live person. You won't get a recording. You won't get a, you know, push number one to speak with so-and-so.
No.
You're not going to get that. You're going to get a human being, and they're going to take
the personal
your pledge.
Touch.
That's right. We are your community. We are all one community. Won't you join us? 877-500-5266 or go online, kboo.fm.
It's easy to do. It just takes a moment of your time, and it's one of the most important things that you can do today, because your support to KBOO, again, ensures access to these airwaves protected for the community to be used by the community members. These airwaves, they are part of our common treasury in which we all share. And it is so important that you are able to actually support independent radio, community radio, so that we can take full advantage of this public resource that is the airwaves, that is that thing we hold in common. 877-500-5266. It is important that you see yourself as a part of KBOO Community Radio. You are already there with your ears, with your mind, with your spirit. We ask that you join us with your pocketbook as well. Become a new member of KBOO or a renewing member to KBOO today. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm. We're about 15% behind our overall goal for this membership drive, so we do need your support right now. Looking to raise $250. In the next 6 minutes, really.
That's not too much.
And we can do it. Again, with your support, all things are possible. 877-500-5266. I do want to thank Beaterville Cafe and Bar at 2201 North Killingsworth Street. Also, Voodoo Donut at 1501 Northeast Davis Street. Spicy Pickle at 1220 Southwest 6th Avenue. And La Happy at 1011 Northwest 16th Avenue. These are the restaurants that have supported the membership drive by donating food today, and we thank them very much for doing so. That's how they've supported our community. Won't you support us with your call? 877-500-5266. Ask for your autographed copy of The Shelter Cycle by Peter Rock when you dial 877-500-5266.
Thank you, Ani and Ivan, and thanks to those of you who have called. And please do support Between the Covers and the work that goes into this program every week. And I am back with the end of the interview with Peter Rock. And one thing I wanted to make sure people heard a little bit about from you, Peter, was your experiences revisiting this area and actually getting to tour the shelters of the Shelter Cycle. Talk about what that was like for you to do that, how you got to do that, I guess, and then what it was like.
It was, as I said, a kind of gradual earning of people's trust. I think the fact that I was writing fiction and that I didn't really have an axe to grind, and anyone who would talk to me realized I couldn't sharpen an axe anyway, that I was just really curious. And I, you know, one person would recommend I talk to someone else. So through people's recommendations, I got closer. And I guess I would distinguish, there's a lot of shelters in a place called Glastonbury, which is a little ways up Paradise Valley. It's a sort of subdivision. And the people who lived there, you had to be a member of the church and you had to have a shelter for your family or for a group of families. And those people had a little more independence than the people on the ranch, as they say, which was down at down near Emigrant, Montana. And they had a shelter down on the main ranch, which was for 700 people. And you could see it on Google Earth. You can look down and see the indentation of it. And that's a shelter you can't access. But a lot of the people I talked to were working on that shelter. And a lot of the people I talked to were contractors also, because they either had the skills or they learned the skills building the shelters. And now they work in Livingston and Bozeman. And an electrician I talked to was the person who wired the big shelter. And it's way up in a place called the heart of the Inner Retreat in the mountains right up against Yellowstone Park. So he could draw diagrams of me, for me, and that was helpful. But I did go into shelters in Glastonbury, and the main woman who I talked to and her father, who I interviewed also, he had built this shelter, which was called Lifesavers, for 70 people. And it's round. It's kind of like a donut underground. So all the walls were curved. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And it also was made in the 80s. So it's kind of like stepping back into the 80s. It's all curved redwood all along the hallways as you travel through it. And when I actually went into it, I was taken into it by someone I didn't know very well. And he was sort of suspicious of me. And I was a little worried because we were pretty far out in the wilderness. And he was saying a lot of things about how, if anything happened, no one would know. And so I've been writing a fair amount about it already. And when I went through the doorways and down the stairs and into the rooms, and the rooms had numbers on them, and you could go in and see all of the encyclopedias and all of the children's shoes that were, you know, getting larger in increments, so for 7 years worth of growth, and all this storage. And I felt, in a way that I never had before, that I was inside a story that I was writing, and that I was inside my mind in some way, but I was also inside a history and of the people I was talking to. And there's such a wide range of belief in the shelters now that there are some people who say we should make our shelter into a bed and breakfast. Oh. And there are other people who have abandoned it and don't pay for the upkeep. And then there are other people I talk to who say, that's my life insurance. We might still need that place. We might still need to go under there. And that shelter was really incredible. You know, it had a great ventilation system and all sorts of, you know, special periscopes and ways to figure out what was happening above ground. And then around it, you know, there's very rudimentary shelters, which are just kind of buried train cars or doors in the sides of mountains. And then other ones that were just completely collapsed in that I could drop into outside of houses where, you know, the ground had collapsed onto them and you could see the storage and you could see the rooms that had been underground.
Fascinating. I'm sorry to tell you that we're out of time, Peter. It went really fast, especially with our breaks, but I thank you so much for coming into KBOO. I've been speaking with Peter Rock, who teaches at Reed College. The title of his latest book is The Shelter Cycle. Very nice to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance? Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
Good morning and welcome to Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And O.B. Hill,
Reflections Mirror Image Books.
Our guest today is Jonathan R. Miller, and we're going to talk to him about his book Delivery and a number of other things. Jonathan, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you, everybody. Nice to be here. I appreciate it.
Okay, and thank you for choosing the opening music. It sounded so great. For those of you who were wondering, we were listening to Moments Notice, which is from the album Blue Train by John Coltrane. So it's always good to start off in sort of a smooth, kind of jazzy mood.
I love it.
Okay, Jonathan, tell us about your latest work, Delivery. We want to talk about some of your other books, too, but could you start us off with an introduction to this particular book?
Sure. First of all, you know, I'm an author of literary fiction thrillers that feature biracial or multiracial or multicultural characters and themes. And so that's the overall flavor. And my latest book, Delivery, it's about a biracial Somali man from the East African country of Somalia. He immigrates with his teenage daughter to Minneapolis, Minnesota, which has a large Somali population, the largest in the United States. Oh. And there he works as a freelance delivery driver. And during the course of one of his deliveries, he kind of runs across a criminal ring. And then, you know, it goes on from there.
Why a Somali character? I'm just thinking that there are so many biracial people in this country who could form the basis for a book. So why this particular one? Why Somali?
Sure. And, you know, and obviously I have interest. You know, I'm biracial myself, black and white. So I have interest certainly in what happens in America. But as far as immigration, you know, I became interested in Somalia. You know, it's been in the news a lot. You know, it's they're in the process of forming a constitution for the government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately it's in the news for a lot of negative reasons, but right. You know, I started reading more and more about it, and, you know, generally speaking, I found that there's this sort of resourcefulness and strength to the culture, you know, again, generally speaking, that, you know, that I wanted the main character, you know, to have an element of that. So that was the main reason of including, you know, Somali perspective.
Is biraciality an issue in the Somali community?
You know, I don't know that it is, and I should say, you know, I'm not an expert. It wasn't a decision I made lightly, you know, kind of taking on this perspective that's not my own. I mean, it's a somewhat precarious thing to try to do. So I don't know that it particularly is, but, you know, some of it is this universal kind of outsider status, and yes. And what I sort of wanted to do was have the character walk this really thin line between, you know, on one hand, there's the Somali